I think of you like food. I think of you like wine. I shouldn't lick my fingers. I'm drinking all the time.
Hey everybody, this is Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine. Welcome to our feature interview for our November 2018 issue of Chicago Jazz Digital Magazine, available at chicagojazzmagazine.com. This is our feature interview with Blue Note recording artist Patricia Barber. We sat down with Patricia, talked all about her upbringing, her life in music, the Gold Star Sardine Bar, the Green Mill, touring the world, and much more. So hopefully you enjoy this interview, and let's get to it. I am so honored to have Patricia Barber sit down with us here. We're going to talk all about her musical career, coming up in music, all the very cool places you have played outside of Chicago, in Chicago, coming up. But first, Patricia, thanks for being on our feature interview for November 2018, Chicago Jazz Digital Magazine.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
You know, it's been a long time coming. I've seen you perform many a time. I don't think we've ever met in person, maybe once or twice, but probably very briefly. But, you know, I've always loved your music. I love the creativity. I love all the textures, the lyric, everything. But before we get all into that, why don't we talk a little bit? You're actually in the process of really putting together a new recording that might come out sometime in the spring. Is that where we're at now?
Absolutely, yes. We'll be recording either in December or January, and it should be out in the spring. We have a big tour scheduled for the spring, so they should be coordinated. We're trying to do that, trying to coordinate those things.
But I mean, is it all originals? Is it just, you know, is there anything standard-wise, or how's this?
This particular album that's coming out in the spring will be a mixture of original material and some standards. About half my records have been that, and about half have been all original. The all original records are, you know, quite a project. That's quite a project to do that. And it's a specific thing. It seems to be accepted by the critics as an important event in jazz and in songwriting. But it's a different thing. More of a crowd pleaser is a mixture of the original material and the standards.
Sure, yeah, because they have something that they understand, and then you're putting your twist on. When it comes to the original stuff, I mean, how do you go into the writing mode? I mean, it's something like all of a sudden when you're planning for this recording, which I think is, you haven't done like an original recording, studio recording in a couple of years, right?
Right.
How does this come about? I mean, is something just hit you and say, you know what, I think I'm going to put an original recording together. I'm going to write these tunes because I'm inspired in a certain way.
I'm writing all the time. I'm writing every day. It's what I, when I get up in the morning, I meditate, and then I read if I'm at home, and then I read, and then I write something like poetry, you know.
Is it kind of like a rough version of poetry, just kind of freeform?
And I definitely refer to it later, and it helps me. And then I have different notebooks. So one notebook is sort of for the freeform poetry, prose poetry, and then one notebook is definitely for, okay, this is going to be a song lyric, and so that's much more serious, and so I refer back to the post poetry thing. But I this is what I do. I do music.
Right, this is your living.
This is what I do. I write music, and I perform it, and I practice the piano, and so this is really what I do. I also, you know, thank God now, when I was 26 years old, one of my best friends, Jovan Turbojevic, who is famous in Chicago for having opened Jovan and Le Nomad and Le Perroquet restaurateur, we became best friends. He told me at 26 years old to start saving money. And I said, why? That's ridiculous. You know, I felt, you know,
I'm 26.
You know, yeah, you know how you feel when you're, that's ridiculous. He said, he was Serbian, he had a Serbian accent. Think of it as having a great aunt with a lot of money, and it will save you from humiliation. And the word humiliation got through the head of a 26-year-old. That word made sense to me because I thought, oh, my God, he's right. I'll be playing at the Ramada Inn on some highway. He's right. He's absolutely right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I started saving money right then and there, and I bought some real estate, and now – now that Spotify, you know, is really taking a lot of the money away from musicians, I'm really glad I did.
Well, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, there's so many roads we can go down.
Right.
And I'm trying to not ask the questions I want to ask.
Right,
you know?
Right. Sorry.
But it's interesting to me because, you know, we have a lot of musicians watching this and a lot of young musicians and everything like that. They don't tell you any of that in music school.
No.
That, you know.
Well, maybe they do. I wouldn't know. Maybe they do.
I could tell you they don't.
Okay. All right.
For about 90% of music schools.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's pretty interesting. So at 26... I mean, you couldn't have been saving all that much money, but you just kind of got in your head and you started putting things away, right? And that allowed you to be able to do what you're doing now rather than worrying about other things.
Right. Like, it's really true. It's not what you make, it's what you save. So, granted, a jazz musician can't make all that much money, but you can still save money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took him quite seriously, and I sold my car.
A car is a big expense,
and I walked to work every day. I ate at the club where I could, so I didn't have to spend money on food. I moved from an Evanston apartment down to a loft, artsy loft apartment in the city, and I really cut my expenses, and I started keeping track of how much money I could save. And I would save in $20 bill segments. Whatever I would, I would get for CDs, which again was a great form of income in the old days.
Sure.
Yeah. And I saved money that way, by $20 bills.
When you're living like that, like when you moved, and we didn't even get into how you got to Chicago, but that's all right. This is a freeform interview here at Chicago Jazz Magazine.
It's turned out to be pretty freeform,
And most of the viewers that watch my shows know this is the way it always goes anyways.
Good.
But when you're moving from Evanston down into the city, now, were you playing at the Gold Star at that
yes,
point?
Yes, I was.
Okay, so just to back up a little bit, you were playing at the Gold Star Sardine Bar 6 nights a week.
Yes.
When you moved into a loft, I mean, did you find all of a sudden your creativity maybe expanded? Because now you're kind of living a little frugally, you're living like an artist, you're in this loft space, or it didn't matter really?
Are you suggesting that no, it didn't.
No, what I'm thinking is that there's a different energy.
There is a different energy. There is. And also, I moved into a loft that was actually specifically for artists.
Okay.
So I was surrounded by painters and other kinds of artists. And so, yeah, there was a different kind of energy. And my loft was an open box, And in order to get to bed, into my bed, you had to climb a ladder.
Oh, really?
Right. You actually had to climb a ladder, which made it interesting if you were going to have a couple drinks or if by chance you were going to have a guest. It had to be a real decision. It was a commitment, So that was an interesting part of my life, young.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because I find, like, living in the city, I came in from the suburbs back in 2004, and I started Chicago Jazz Magazine in 2002, so there's that whole thing. But I was living in the suburbs. When I got into the city and I would walk out my door, it's just a different vibe. And I feel like that sometimes that, even with a lot of musicians, there's just a different vibe, different kind of frame of mind.
True.
Maybe like, you're going to push yourself a little harder. I don't know what it is, but I feel like it's an energy thing.
Well, it's absolutely true. Actually, to go back before the Gold Star Sitting Bar, when I first got to Chicago, I got hired a lot. I got hired in all the suburbs, and I got fired from every single job. Yeah,
What kind of gigs were you?
Well, I was a piano bar girl, And I got fired from every single job. Either it was something the owner didn't like about the selection of music, or a lot of times I was supposed to be the B-girl on my breaks. And instead, what I would do is go on my breaks and work on music or read a book, right? But I was supposed to socialize with the men at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that wasn't my thing. So I just said no, and then boom, I was fired. So I have been fired from, you list a suburb, and I've probably worked there and have been fired there. When I got to the city, I got to the Westin Hotel, and I got that gig there. It was a trio gig, and it was my first major gig, and I never got fired again.
You were doing your own thing, right?
I never got fired. It was the difference between the suburban mentality and the city mentality. I never got fired again. I worked nonstop. I'm still working. And it was just a different thing. All they wanted from me was to do great music and to draw people in to listen to the music and have a drink.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's amazing too. I mean, so you came up, just I'll timeline it back a little bit. You grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and then you went to school at University of Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
But growing up in Chicago,
Nebraska got in there after age 9.
My
father died. My mother and I took one small car and moved to Sioux City, Iowa, where in fact a great aunt had left us a house. And we slept on the floor because we didn't have money or furniture. And my mother, at 45 years old, went to college at Morningside College in Sioux City. Yeah.
Because she hadn't gone. Now she's like, I've got to provide.
I have to support a daughter. Yeah. So she went to college. Nobody did that back then, and she ended up with a master's degree. And wow. She remarried my stepfather, Cecil Orton, and we moved across the river to South Sioux City, Nebraska. So I really had many of my most formative years in Nebraska.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I mean, out there now, your father was a jazz musician. Right. And he was with Glenn
Floyd
Miller?
Floyd Barber. He was friends with Glenn Miller from Sioux City, Iowa. So they were pals, and he was often a sub for their band. But he did not travel with their band because he had gone back to graduate school at the University of Iowa to get a pharmacy degree to support a family.
Ah, okay. Yeah. I mean, were you influenced by any jazz at that point?
Oh, my God.
It was all over the place.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
He and my mother just loved jazz and music, and especially you know, the American classic songbook.
Right.
My mother loved Billie Holiday. Billie Holiday was her favorite singer.
Did she sing?
She's a fabulous singer.
Oh.
Fabulous. You would mistake her maybe for Mahalia Jackson. She just has a huge voice. And, yeah. Wonderful singer. So not at all. We don't have the same voice at all. She used to tell me to jazz it up. Jazz it up, Pat. You know? Yeah.
So you were influenced at a young age with jazz, and your father, I mean, did he?
He played saxophone around the house, and I would stick my hand in the bell where you could actually feel the music. That was fun. And he taught me piano, starting at like 4 or 5. He taught me piano. And then...
Did you take to it, or was it something that he just...
I took to it right away.
Okay.
And I have two older sisters, and... You know, they tried with them, and the gene wasn't there. You know, there is a musical gene. There just is. And I took to it right away so that they would, like, oh, my God, let's get her a piano teacher. So they did.
So you started playing really young.
Yeah, right, like 5.
Wow.
Yeah.
Were you playing standards? I mean, was
no.
it because, I mean, it's like because
well,
you're
5, I think I was playing Twinkle, Twinkle, right, Little Star, you know.
But I mean, was it the reason why I'm going is because I know that in college, didn't you? I mean, you studied psychology,
right?
And classical music, right?
Exactly.
So there
yeah.
wasn't jazz. Where you learned, but did you know tunes and stuff at that point?
No,
was just like
no, I didn't. I was trying not to be a jazz musician. I was going
because you saw what your dad or something.
Yeah,
or,
yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was trying not to live that lifestyle. I was trying not to do that, and my mother was very worried about the lack of security being a jazz musician.
What lack of security?
Yeah,
what's the problem? Hey.
And so I was really trying not to, and it was just a pull I couldn't avoid. And I remember I called her, I think senior year in college. I was just about to get a double degree in classical piano and psychology, and I said, you know, I'm going to be a jazz musician, and she cried.
Really?
She cried. And
were you playing jazz in college?
I wasn't. I was the girl singer in a lounge band, which was a great job.
Yeah.
You know, I had a job every weekend, so I got to make money, and that was wonderful.
Yeah. Was it like rock and pop
yeah.
and all that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the first job I got when I came to Chicago was in Alan Kay's band. I was the stand-up girl singer.
Mm-hmm.
And people
I remember the Alan Kay. I mean, I remember the name, the Alan Kay.
I was a stand-up girl singer, if you can believe it. I had evening gowns and the...
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've done everything.
Yeah, I have done everything.
So when did
I represent a century, yeah.
when did you start getting serious? I mean, obviously, if you're playing classical music, playing, you know, piano, classical piano, you've got chops.
Yeah.
But transferring, and you tell me, I mean, maybe it was totally natural for you, but I found that I mean, you know, I'm a percussionist drummer,
mm-hmm.
and going from reading music all the time mm-hmm. and being ingrained mm-hmm. and then trying to improvise was a huge switch for me. It was just like, you know, like a brain switch.
Right.
And I think that's the same with a lot of classical players trying to switch or play
right.
jazz. Was it easy for you? How did you even
on the side,
transfer that?
On the side.
Yeah.
I was always playing pop or jazz.
Okay.
I was always playing pop or jazz. So it wasn't that difficult for me to start improvising. I wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely wasn't a very good pianist, jazz pianist. But you're right, having a lot of facility from playing, you know, Bach fugues and such helps. And, you know, then I just, you know, you do what all jazz musicians do. I got work because the singer got work for the pianist, for sure.
Right.
The young woman singer got work for a mediocre jazz pianist.
Sure.
And then I had all those years to work at it. And having, you know, other musicians, you know, like we all grab musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a
yep.
way that we learn. You hear somebody you like and you say, would you mind giving me a couple lessons? And that was very important, you know, so.
When did you get to the point where you didn't have to hire a piano player? And you could just do the vocal and the piano. I mean, because if you're hiring piano players all the time, you're hiring here or there, but you're starting to get your chops together enough where you feel comfortable.
Oh, no, I always played the piano.
Oh, you did.
I was making some sort of a reference to a double persona.
I got it.
A double
okay.
persona.
Okay.
But I always played, even if I was just playing badly or playing mediocre.
What kind of gigs were they? Like the piano bar gigs and stuff?
Piano bar gigs, yeah. Some of them had a tip jar. Some of them went till 5 in the morning. A lot of them went to 5 in the morning, mm-hmm. Both on Rush Street, on the northwest side, and then I got the Westin Hotel gig, which was a trio gig, and that was really the beginning of this just a wonderful life in Chicago for me. At some point, I had to decide, did I want to move to New York or not, and I decided I didn't need to.
Right.
I could kind of see that the airport from Chicago was the same as the airport from New York, and I could kind of see that that things were sort of decentralizing, and I just didn't feel that was necessary.
Yeah. Well, you know, coming up, the way you came up, and you're playing that you've got these piano bar gigs, even if you're getting fired from them, and everything else, you're learning, you're getting your chops together and stuff, but I think that's such a gap now compared to, like, it's not there for the kids, right? So, I mean, they come out of college, and they might know how to play, they might know tunes, they might know, you know, all this stuff, but they don't have that seasoning where you go on a gig. Right.
That's everything.
It is everything.
It's really everything. They come right out of school now, and they, and it's just everything. And I don't understand, to this day, I don't understand why when you go to a club or you go to a restaurant, what do you hear on the speaker system? You hear jazz.
You do? Yep.
It's either like classic jazz like Diana Krall, but it's still jazz, or you hear actually jazz. Musicians don't cost any more than they did. I mean, I hope I'm not divulging a secret, but musicians do not cost any more than they did in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Sad to say. So why didn't you just hire a bass player and a pianist, and you would give life and vibration to the room, and, you know, and I used to create my own gigs by walking into a place and saying, you know, for $200 a night, you can have real music here, and I guarantee you'll have more people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have more people, you can fire me. And that's how I made gigs.
I think it's the same nowadays too, but I think that, you know, there's generations of general managers now at all of these clubs and bars and restaurants and everything. They just don't know. They don't know how to hire a musician. They don't know how to approach a musician, because when I'll get a call through Chicago Jazz Magazine or whatever, hey, can you recommend somebody? Because somebody said that we should have some music in here. They have no clue about what it would take or how little it would take, not only just the hiring, but the space or whatever. You're not really losing anything. You travel all over the world. Do you see in Europe, is there more live music in clubs like that rather than in the States?
Well, you know, when I'm in Europe, the last thing I'm going to do is go out to a club.
Yeah.
I mean, when I'm not working.
Right.
I'm exhausted, or I'm just staying in a hotel watching TV, or I'm on a plane. But, you know, in Europe they have state support for the arts, so there you have definitely more music everywhere, but in performance centers, but also smaller performing arts centers. In Poland, whatever else is happening in Poland, you have music everywhere. In every little town, big town in Poland, you have the university music schools, but you also have private music schools everywhere. So you're walking down the street and you see these old-fashioned, you know, little town Poznan music school of music.
Really?
Yeah. So you have knowledgeable audiences. You have wonderful audiences.
Yeah.
You know, it's very similar in Germany and France, and they just have state support for the arts, and it makes a big difference.
I also think that in the States specifically, let's relate it back to jazz. Back in the 70s and 80s and 90s, all of these clubs and everything, there weren't the TVs on the walls. There wasn't this, there wasn't that. I think that has a big thing to do with it because, you know, people start looking at the bottom line, looking at the numbers and all that stuff. I think you're right, though. In Europe, there's that other entity, that state support.
Right.
So they don't have to worry about anything. They're like, okay, well, we're going to have these people do this, and everything's kind of sponsored and presented that way, right? I mean, that's...
Personally, I still think I would recommend that the young kids do what I did. I can tell you right now, I've been to Nomi Restaurant, the one that's Hyatt. Boy, right there, there's a spot between the bar, and then you go into the restaurant, and then there's a maitre d' standing in front of the restaurant. Right there in the bar, there's a beautiful piano, and nobody playing it.
Yeah.
So if I were 26 years old, I would go in there and say, listen, let me come in here with a bass player and we'll play a cocktail hour for you. We'll play 5 to 8 for this much money, and I think you're gonna gain.
Yeah.
I would try that. That's what I used to do. I used to just knock down the places, and you have a million hotels in Chicago that used to have trios. But, you know, hit on them. Try it. Talk to those food and beverage managers and say, just explain it. If they don't know, explain it to them.
Yeah.
You know, how much have they lost when Judy Roberts left the Continental? Intercontinental.
Unbelievable, right?
Right. What a loss. I've looked at that. Every time I go by there, I look in the room to see what it is now. It's a chocolate. It's for chocolate. It's empty. It's this. Right. It's empty. You know, that was just, have her back.
Well, it's crazy. That's like you're at the mill every Monday night.
Right.
Packed.
Right.
You know, I mean, it starts at 9.
Right.
And it's packed.
Crazy.
Right? 9 o'clock on a Monday.
9 o'clock.
And it's packed.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's that. That's the Dave Gemmello element, right, too, is that, you know, he figured that out. But before we get into Dave Gemmello, I'm going to bring it back here. So you're at the Westin with
a
trio.
You're personally interested in Bill Allen, aren't you?
I am very interested in Bill Allen.
Okay.
But I was in the Gold Star a couple of times before it closed.
All right.
But not when you were playing. I think Stephanie Browning was there at that point. Mm-hmm. But it's such a little hole-in-the-wall nook.
Yeah.
Now, so were you at the Westin, or was it around that time that did he approach you? How did that happen? So the Gold Star Sardine Bar, for the people that are watching this outside of the city, mm-hmm. or the people that don't know what it is, it's like what? It seats about 20 people, 20, 30 people
30
maybe?
30 people maybe, yeah.
Right? And there was a grand piano in there.
Yeah.
And it was a stage.
There's an actual stage, you know, which is apart from the, it's on a riser. Yeah.
And it was inside of a... like a condo building, right?
It's a tiny bar, yeah. It's inside a condo building. And, yeah, it was all painted black.
It's still there.
I know it's still there. It's identical.
There are private parties there. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah. Eric Schneider, I think, played a private party there. And he's like, it's like walking into a time warp.
It is, because it's still the way it was, yeah.
So were you the first person playing there? Was that?
Yeah, I think I went on a really long vacation and then there was a union issue at the Westin, and I ended up not working there. And I don't think I was fired. I don't think I was fired from the gig. I'm pretty sure I wasn't. But I ended up taking some time off, and then I ran into Neil Tesser. If you can, you know, it's Chicago. At some place, we were chatting, and he said, why don't you go over to this new place, the Gold Star, and talk to a guy named Bill Allen? So I did. It was during the day, and he was there, and you know what a bar is like in the day. It's very different than it is at night.
Mm-hmm,
he was there, and we sat at a table, and I said, you know, I can... Oh, I didn't tell him I could sing. I said, I'm just a pianist, because I didn't want the personal element of singing. If you're an introvert, it's a little bit difficult to get used to. I have stage fright. So I just thought, well, if I can just get a gig as a pianist with a trio, that would be great. So I told him that I was a pianist, and he made me go up on stage and play some things, and he hired me. And
that was easy.
That was that. And then I was there for 11 years after that. Yeah.
Wow. And, so you were there, was it right off the bat, 6 nights a week?
Yeah, right off the bat, nights a week.
With
a
trio?
With a trio. I worked with Rusty Jones, was one of my main drummers there for years. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So at the Westin, you weren't, how many nights a week were you at the Westin when you were doing the Westin?
Five.
Yeah. All right. So that's, the gigs were actually five and six. Right. I mean, that was like almost like a regular thing around town at that point.
That was the thing. That was the thing. It was called a house gig.
Right.
That's what a house gig was.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I ran into Paul Marino the other night. We went to see him at the Jazz Showcase, and he was saying, you know, it had been really tough because he had played four nights in a row, and I was like,
And now he's got like a whole week off.
Well, you should be so lucky, you know. right. So
isn't that amazing? Yeah. I mean, that whole Rush Street area and everything was just popping five, 6 nights.
Right, and you know, you get used to that. You get used to that work ethic, and you get used to playing that many nights. I mean,
How long a night was it at the Gold Star?
5 hours.
5 hours.
Five
too,
hours.
Right?
Yeah.
You get 3 hours, and people get exhausted these days, right?
5 hours, and John Weber, I think, wins the award for working at the Four Seasons.
Oh yeah.
6 nights a week, 5 hours a night solo.
Yes.
I mean, he wins the award for
how many years? Like 15, 20 years or something.
Yeah.
Crazy.
But those were house gigs.
Yeah.
And they, you know, that ends up paying you a living. You can make a living, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But in the process, did you come out with your first album by then, or you were just starting to
release things? No, I did my first album when I was working at the Gold Star. It really helped me prepare for that. Yeah.
And tell me the process. Are you're there, you're playing standards. Are you able to start sliding? Would you start singing, or how did that?
Yeah, well, one night he brought up another singer, as he was wont to do. And so there was a vocal mic up there, you know, and I had.
And you're just doing piano.
I've been singing before at the Westin. It was crazy to me that he didn't really know. But, you know, he didn't know that yet. You know, nobody knew. And so I just decided I was going to sing one song and see, you know, just for fun. And of course, everybody stopped. And he stopped, and he was like, keep doing that. Keep doing that. I think you could be a singer. I'm going, really? Do you think I could be a singer? Really? What do you suggest I do? And he's like, just keep doing what you're doing. So I became a singer, pianist.
Thanks to Bill Ellen.
Right.
Not really.
And and what happened was that when I started there, there was essentially no audience. And then quickly within a year, there were lines around the block.
How did that happen back then? Was it somebody wrote you up or somebody talked about
yeah,
it?
Because well,
I mean, the internet's not there, so.
Yeah, we got written up. Howard Reich was certainly a part mm-hmm. of that. He would, you know, come to the Gold Star. And yeah, we got written up. But also, Bill Allen had a huge publicity marketing campaign going on because he had people like Bobby Short come in.
Right, that's
so
right.
So there was a constant PR campaign for the Gold Star, which made it hipper and hipper and hipper, you know.
And then it turned into something.
And then it turned into a kind of a small gold mine.
So that had to be something. Now, were you allowed to play your original stuff
no,
there?
No, not at all. It was only standards, which is ultimately why I left. But boy, did I learn the standards. I knew them anyway
right.
from my mother and my father yeah. and, you know, from the piano bars. But I really, really learned them. And I had 5 hours a night to play with the trio to get my piano together.
Yeah.
You know, I could tape myself and bring it back home and go, ooh, you know, and try it in different keys, play in different keys. It was just such an opportunity. And if that's what I would say for younger people, if you can get a gig.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and I want to go back to the standards, too, because I always like to bring this up for anybody at this point, any musician, but especially the kids that are in college or 20 or 30 years old or 40 years old. It seems like this day and age, and I'm totally, you know, supportive of it, the original music, you know, for even the younger kids writing original compositions and everything. But I feel like sometimes they come out and they don't have that depth of the jazz standards or where the music came from before they start writing original music.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like to me that you had such a grasp on the depth of the standards, whether you actually meant to do that or just out of necessity, you just learned it so
right.
deeply, that had to be a huge help when you went to start writing your original compositions.
Oh, it was. It was. I knew the harmony, you know, backwards and forwards. My ear was attuned to great, great music. Michael Arnapol worked with me for 30 years.
Wow, 30 years, really?
Altogether, 30 years. But we really knocked down those nights at the Gold Star. And I just kept bringing in new charts, so that I have a book that must be... So we would do experiments and how long we could go, how many weeks we could go without repeating a song. That's
wow.
what a huge repertoire we have.
And these are all like standards.
These are
right?
all standards,
standards,
you know, Glad to Be Unhappy, all the Rodgers and Hart stuff, all the Cole Porter stuff. I would just go through composers and put them in my key and start working with arrangements. Do I want this to be like a, you know, a Latin beat,
yeah.
a swing? What's the difference between four and two?
Mm-hmm.
How does a singer sound best? And then for me, the thing practicing at home was I needed my hands to be exactly on the beat with the band, and I needed to pull my voice away from anything that sounded like that. So I learned how to to get my voice off of the beat and to make the phrasing sound like I'm standing up in a studio singing over another pianist.
You know, when you say that, I never have thought about that, but that's got to be a huge
yeah.
flip, right?
It's you have to really work on that and tape yourself and make sure that, yeah, it's like splitting your brain in two. Yeah.
Do you think, and, you know, we're not going to name names, but do you think that kind of puts, like, you know, people like yourself, maybe Diana Krall, people like that can play and sing, and it sounds like if you close your eyes or you didn't have any clue
right.
of who it was, it
right.
sounded like there's two people
right.
there, as opposed to other musicians that haven't broken that mold. That's like a really, you know, intense concept.
Right.
I'm wondering how many people actually think about that when they're singer piano players.
Well, if you listen to yourself on a recording, you're going to think about it really fast. You know, when I teach, I tell my students, you know, grab a recording device. It's an iPhone now. You know, back then
it's
was
so easy.
You know,
it's
grab
like
one and record yourself, and it's the best way to find out that you sound bad or you're, you know, just keep doing it. If you insist on scatting, do it. Do it on a recording and listen to yourself. And if you think it sounds bad, you might consider not doing it. You know, but a recording will tell you the truth. So
that's the problem with recordings. That's
right.
why I stopped doing that when I was playing drums. I'm like, oh God. I
who's
sound
the,
great
the
up here.
Great guitarist that plays guitar and sings. I just can't think of his name right now.
He's
the son of another jazz musician.
Oh, Pizzarelli.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure at some point in his career,
John Pizzarelli,
probably very young, he had to do the same thing. He had to learn to play with the other musicians, so you play, you know, on the beat, and then he had to make sure that his voice sounded like it was naturally phrasing, yeah, like you're a stand-up singer.
Yeah. You know, and talking about that, playing with other musicians, because, you know, as a drummer, I always relate it back to what I understand. I'm sure it's the same as you, but when you're playing just piano with an upright, you know, bass and drums, your brain is splitting because you're hearing the bass, you're hearing the drums, right, you're interacting off of that and everything else. And then to be able to sing and interact off of that, that's something that's got to just be, you probably just have to have gigs to work on that, right? There's no real good way to practice that.
Gigs. You can practice at home, you know, and I think you can tell that I do practice at home because sometimes my left hand goes down to hit the bass note. Mm-hmm. That's a dead giveaway.
Right.
When I have a bass player, that's a dead giveaway to me. Yeah. It's not to, I always think, oh my God, everybody noticed. But of course, only the bass player noticed. The bass player didn't notice.
He's looking right at you,
right,
too.
And that's because I practice at home. Because I want to hear the bass, you know, so I hit the bass note and then I come back off to play.
So. Yeah. Well, all right, so you're at the Gold Star. You end up leaving the Gold Star. You put, how many recordings did you put out there? Just the one?
One, split, yeah.
Okay.
Split.
So then you left just because it was getting to a point where you're probably getting inquiries from other places, you had other options, or it was just kind of wearing on you a little bit, just doing the same thing every night? Because as an artist, it's got to get a little old, maybe.
Well, you know, I lasted the longest there, and Bill Allen is notoriously difficult, was notoriously difficult to work with. So lasting 9 years full-time, 11 years less than full-time, is an absolute record. And talk to, you know, Jeremy Kahn or the other people that played there, and they will say the same thing, that, you know, it's amazing how she, I mean, we had fights that would clear the room.
Like there? Like in
the... Oh, yeah. He never, you would fight in the back room too, but he didn't care about fighting right out in public. So I'd be playing, you know, and he'd like, that sounds like shit. Yeah, he'd just scream
that. From the
that.
Back of the bar?
No, right, he's at the front table. Oh, he'd like to be at the front table. So he would be at the front table with his friends or whatever, you know, and he'd say, that sounds, you know, and I'd say, what do you mean? What? What part sounds like shit, you know? And we would just, and then, you know.
He'd
say, oh, God. Oh, yeah. And we had so many fights. They were just legendary. And one time he shouted up at me, and this was from behind the bar, so it was even louder. If you ever, that sounded horrible. If you ever play Gershwin again, you will be fired, right? So, like, right.
First tune.
So, I took a break. Took a break to gather my thoughts. And sure enough, I went up and played an entire set of Gershwin, as I can do, as we proved that Michael and I had proven that we could do that. Yeah. So Rusty and Michael and I played an entire set of George Gershwin, which it gets a little stretchy. You know, I Loved You, Porgy, Embraceable You, you know, you're really searching there for the more Gershwin. I did an entire set of Gershwin, and everybody's waiting to see when. I thought maybe he'd shut off the power. I wasn't sure how exactly this was going to happen, if there was a cane and it was going to come and get me.
Get the hook.
Nothing happened, right? So I just kept going, and then I ended the set as normal. But he had gone in the back room, locked the door, and the bartender had my coat, was holding my coat. And he said, Bill says to tell you you're fired. And everybody watched. I picked up my coat, and I took it home, and I came back the next night, the same time, and I wasn't fired.
You just came back.
Yeah. I just came back. I knew I wasn't fired, you know.
That's hilarious. You just show back up and say, hey, well, I don't know.
Yeah. I just knew I wasn't fired.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I came back, and in a certain way, he enjoyed the fact that I stood up to him because so many people didn't.
Yeah, he was a real strong personality,
right? And he just enjoyed the fact that I would, you know, and we had a fight one time in the middle of the bar, and I'm tall, right? And so he was tall, and our faces were like, this was the typical Chicago fight, you know, and he's like this, and he was like, I could hit you, and I'm like, hit me right in front of all these people? You're going to hit a woman? Seriously? Knock me down, big boy, you know? And we had this, and like everybody was just like this, you know?
Oh.
And so I think I lasted because I stood up to him, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess.
But what made you not just say, I had enough of this guy, man? I mean, you just knew the deal, but the gig was so good that you loved the creativity that was happening there?
Well,
I mean, there had to be a reason you stayed. I mean,
well, you know, as he got older, you know, drinking alcohol,
right.
and there started to be some problems.
Mm-hmm.
And he started getting harder and harder to deal with. Yeah. And yes, after 11 years, it gets to be wearing. So starting about 8 years in, I started asking for a raise every year. And I mean a substantial raise.
Right.
So I started asking for an unbelievable amount of money per night. And the reason, of course, I had stayed there is because we were drawing huge crowds
sure.
all the time.
Sure.
And so that, I mean, but he started to get mad at me, you know,
yeah.
knowing that I was manipulating him. And I would go off to Europe for a 5 or 6 week holiday, right? And and then come back and start my job. And then I'd say, by the way, it's going to cost $100 more per night.
Right.
You know, so I actually made enough money there to buy my first house.
Wow.
You know, yeah. And also made the CD.
Mm-hmm.
But my sister lent me $10,000 for that, which was great.
Yeah.
But I paid her back, and I doubled her money, and that's the money. Money was flowing in that place like water. It was just like cash.
It was all cash.
Like
right?
all
it
cash.
Was
it was just
flying.
Like unbelievable. Of course, yeah. I reported every dollar.
Of course.
And,
yeah.
And
but when you were there, and you're drawing all of these crowds, did you have the ability, like when you would leave for 5 weeks? I mean, were you able to tour? Were there people asking you to come play other places? I
Not
mean,
yet.
You had
no.
to be.
At first, I just wanted to see the world. I
okay.
had practiced until I was, you know, 30 years old. I decided at 30 that was it. I needed to see the world. So I started just to tour, just to see the world. And I loved it. It was, you know, wonderful, wonderful. These were wonderful trips. And then Richard Seidel called when I was still working at the Gold Star. He was the huge guy at the time for Polygram.
Mm-hmm.
So he called and asked me if I would do a record of standards, and I said no. I wanted to be my own person, and I.
Were there a lot of stipulations on what you guys were talking about, or it was just like, I'm gonna be Patricia Barber. I'm not.
Well, I said
about
I want to write my own music, and I've started writing my own music, and I would want to do a record of my own music. And he said, no, you know, in the Diana Krall,
right.
you know, sort of mold, we could use you as, you know. So,
right.
And I said, no. And that became legendary. Then the guy from Concord.
That didn't bother you when you did it. You just, because you were a very strong person. So
yeah, it didn't
just
bother me.
Okay.
I didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
I really didn't want to do that. I had had many years of playing standards, and I just had a feeling that I wanted to create my own voice.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, frankly, I would get bored. I mean,
yeah.
how many times can you do Love for Sale? I mean, you can do it multiple times. But,
right.
And then the guy from Concord Records, Jeffers, in fact, wasn't his name?
I think so.
I think Carl Jeffers.
I think so.
His
I wish
was
I was
Jeffers.
Related to him.
He's dead.
Well, I could still be related to him. But
from Concord Records, called me via my mother. I don't know how he got my mother's number in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I was visiting my mother, and he had a real gruff voice.
Mm-hmm.
He called me. And he said, you know, did I want to do a record for Concord? And I said, well, I have to do my own music. And he said, no. So, you know, so then, but then Mike Friedman of Premonition Records,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, a Chicago label, came up to me and said, would you like to do a record for us? And I said, I would like to do my own music. And he said, absolutely. And so then Cafe Blue.
Yeah.
Before that, I'm sorry, I did do a record for Antilles.
Okay.
Brian Backus came to town. For Antilles Records. Remember Antilles was an offshoot. It was a really cool boutique label. Anyway, I did Distortion of Love for them.
Okay.
And then Mike gave me a really nice offer.
So for Premonition. So that was
yeah.
the first.
Yeah. And he and Gary Witt, Mike Friedman and Gary Witt worked out of Mike's kitchen
mm-hmm.
with the and they really worked their hearts out. And they did all the things that record companies used to do, which was they would prepare the tours for me. And by then I had an agent. It was easy again. I just knew my life was never going to be the same. And then, you know, it was never going to be as quiet and
right.
lovely as it was. But the record companies would go to the towns first, and they would.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
I couldn't even imagine
they
that.
They did,
now.
And they would get the print media on your side, and they would put like little things on the tables and the clubs and.
Oh, really? Like
yeah.
full on?
Yes, full on. In the United States,
yeah.
and then in Europe, you would they would do what they could over there in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you had somebody actually devoted to your account.
Oh,
let's
absolutely.
Call it,
Cafe
and that
Blue
was it. Yeah,
did really well. That
yeah.
was my first record for Premonition, and then Modern Cool sold all original music at that time sold 120,000 copies.
God,
all over the world, which was
that's huge,
astounding.
Yeah.
Or 130,000. I forget which.
But it's also in the jazz genre.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like a pop.
No, it's rarefied music.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's unusual. Yeah. So amazingly so.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But I think to your point though, when you were on a label, they were supporting you.
Absolutely.
There was a push.
Yeah.
Nowadays, and not in your case probably, but nowadays if you're on a small label or you're an up and coming artist or somebody and you get signed to a record label that you're going to pay money to probably to do the promotion, there isn't any support except for what you as an artist does, you know?
That's very
and I mean, it's very rare too, I think, to get any support as a, you know, not even close to that, I'm sure. I mean, you know, that's amazing. So they're setting up tours and stuff. So that was really your breakout, right? I mean, that's kind of when you started getting into the world.
It was modern cool. I mean, Cafe Blue was a big deal. It sold a lot, and it was a big deal, and it was sort of clear to me that I was going to have a recording career. And then I actually went, I thought maybe I would want to go back to school, so I went through a process of looking into a PhD at the University of Chicago, and I was offered.
What were you going to get your degree in?
Ethnomusicology. I wanted to look into the beginning of jazz, you know, really the very beginning.
So you're touring, you're playing gigs, things are starting to break, you're you know, selling 120,000 mm-hmm. copies of something, but then you decide you want to potentially go back and get another degree.
Yeah.
Is that because you're just, I mean, there's people that would just be like, that's it, man, this is great,
right.
let's boogie, let's go.
Yeah.
But it... But it must be something because when you read your lyrics and we're talking about, you know, early in the interview here about, you know, you get up, you meditate, you're seem very grounded, right? Very self-aware in what you want to have happen and you're thinking, you're kind of deeply in thought in the morning, you're writing poetry and stuff. Is that just, that lends itself to going back to school because you're just naturally curious, you want to learn more knowledge and that's the way you want to do it?
Yeah, and I'm also... an introvert, actually. I'm an extroverted introvert is the actual explanation for it. So in order for me to act extroverted, I have to, you know, act it. I have to act it.
Mm-hmm.
But it drains me. It doesn't give me energy. Whereas Renee Fleming is a natural extrovert. You know, people give her energy. And you can see the difference. She's like the sunshine on stage.
Yeah,
she's
yep,
just like,
yep.
You know. So, I would love to go back. I would still love to go back to school. I would love to go back to school now.
So you didn't go back to school. You were thinking about
it. I did get an offer, and I had to decide. And I had already recorded Modern Cool. It was in the can.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't come out yet. And I remember I had finished a gig. By then, it was at the Green Mill. And I had finished the night at the Green Mill, and I was walking down that long Foster Avenue, not Broadway, but Foster Avenue toward the parking lot. I was walking.
Lawrence Avenue.
Yeah, so
yep.
I walked out the door. I felt the wind on my face, and I was walking down, and I was like, University of Chicago School, you know, or a jazz musician.
Right.
You know, which is it. And I had a feeling about Modern Cool, and so that was my choice.
Yeah. So maybe it's interesting that you just said that, because maybe you still had that little thing in your mind back from your mother and everything saying you cannot be a jazz musician.
Right.
You need to get back
right.
to school. You got to
right.
have something to fall back on.
Right, right. Well, I wish I had an extra medical degree for sure, but yeah. yeah.
Well, when I came back from school, everybody told me I needed a degree, so I went back for 2 months. I said, this isn't fun. I don't want to
wow.
do this.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
I knew right away.
Right.
You know, so I think it's something like that. It's like you're already in it, though.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and you're doing your
decision,
own.
I thought that was a hard decision, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you're doing your own stuff. So
yeah.
You're at the mill now.
Yeah.
You've gone from the sardine bar. You broke out. You've got record deals.
Bill started getting, he was always difficult. He started getting more difficult. And I think that the stories from Stephanie Browning, you know, and other
Jeremy and everybody, yeah.
Would be able to tell you, Brad Williams would be able to tell you that he just got more and more difficult.
Yeah.
And so I just started, because it was difficult, I just started raising the price and thinking, well, as long as I can stand it, I'm going to make the money so I can, you know, secure my future,
mm-hmm.
you know, buy a house, which I bought in Humboldt Park. It
yep.
was $84,000 house. That's how I had to start. But, you know, I had to start somewhere. And I just thought, well, I got to secure my future. I have to, you know, save some money. And so as long as I could stand it, and then I just couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
And he fired me. You know, he actually fired me, really for good, fired me. So, but then I was back. Then he called me back, and I went back for
two more.
Yeah, I went back for two more years, so that would be.
But you had your record, though, going. So, I mean, you're out, you're on the record label, you're touring and stuff, and you've got, I mean, you're selling.
No, by then.
I mean, it was after the Gold Star Sardine Bar, though.
After the Gold Star, then I was off for a while. And I was sitting at home going through my savings, trying to decide what to do, reading, educating myself. And I was starting to write music for real and write lyrics. Now, this is a big thing.
And you hadn't been up until that point.
Well, I could write instrumentals, but to write lyrics is a big deal. You know, if you think you can do it, like people who think they can do it, and they're like,
I know.
They tell me they think they can do it, and I'm like, do it.
Right.
Bring it into me. Let's see.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
That's the hardest thing, I think.
It's really tough. And so I started studying the poets and started studying the songwriters. I have notebooks and notebooks and notebooks about where Cole Porter started the melody. Did he start on the root? Did he start on the third? Did he start on the flatted fifth? Where did Sting start his melodies? Where did Joni Mitchell start her melodies?
Yeah.
Where did Jerome Kern start his melodies? Where did they go on the bridge? Most of the time you're going to go up a fourth, but there are variations on that. How do you make the variations? So I learned the American Songbook, the form of it, really well.
Why did you think, because I'm fascinated
I have been singing it, but
concept.
I wanted to know the, you know.
I mean, why, maybe it just goes back to all of the reading and everything that you had done, and you've gone to college for psychology and all that
right.
stuff, but you actually wanted to really analyze where that started. I mean,
because how can you be a songwriter unless you know?
Well, I agree.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, but I'm.
I mean,
it's
you can
fascinating,
be a songwriter like this, you know. 1-4-1
Yeah.
You know, you can do that.
Right.
But if you want to be a songwriter and you want to be a real songwriter,
yes.
you should look at the real songwriters. You should see what they do, how they do it. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating. One night I was looking up lyrics. I was working with lyrics syllables. So syllables actually matter in music different than poetry. In music, you know, they really do matter because everything's rhythmic.
Right.
Right. So I count syllables. I actually count syllables. And then, of course, you have to have the stress on, you know, the stress on the word is important as well. But I was studying Cole Porter and what he did with his lyrics. And he's very systematic. So what sounds so off the cuff and brilliant and charming and, quote, gay is actually like science. It's like a science, right? So I was in bed at night and I was sleeping, and I thought, it can't be that he is so precise that this song is 7 syllables, 6 syllables, 7 syllables, 6 syllables. Can't be so precise. He has to now and then he has to have a over, you know, a syllable that drops out or that, you know, one. And so in the middle of the night, I went and I looked up the song, and I'm like, oh, damn.
It
seven,
is.
Six, without fail.
Wow.
Like science. It's art meets science.
Yeah.
It really is.
That's amazing.
So it's isn't it?
It's amazing.
And
yeah,
isn't it
totally.
Interesting?
It's very interesting.
So, you know, there's a lot that's going on in music. And if you really want to write songs, you just dig into these songwriters. They have everything to teach you.
That's amazing.
More so than I really think a teacher can teach you if you really deconstruct these songs.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. Well, it's fascinating because you're talking about, you know, you're analyzing the lyrics and the music, and you're starting to write. I mean, how much you've analyzed Gershwin, you've analyzed Joni Mitchell, Sting. I mean, what you just talked about is fascinating. How is this, like, when your thought process starts going now? Now you're writing lyrics, and you can play piano. Are you starting to think lyrically and piano? So, and you're thinking this way, like analyzing where you're going to start your lyric, where the syllables. I mean, you know, there's so many things to think about.
There are so many things to think about.
I'm glad I just play drums.
There are so many things to think about. Okay, well, I wish I had a methodology that is, you know, I don't. Each song is different. I can tell you in a broad sort of general way that the more words in a song, the more chatty the song, like Redshift or Company, maybe if it's a funny song or a smart song, the more words, the more simple the harmonic progression will be.
Okay.
Because I am not into high modernism. I'm not going to make it so difficult for you to understand. I really do want to communicate with my audience. So that in general terms, that's so if it's really, really a narrative-driven song with a lot of words, it'll be maybe over a blues changes or some variation.
I mean, you're consciously thinking about this.
Or
obviously.
Some variation of that. A harder song to write is the fine song that is harmonically complex And then you also are going to put lyrics to that. So it doesn't necessarily start with the words. It doesn't necessarily start with the music. It can be one or the other. But at some point, you do have to do both.
That was going to be my
almost
question.
Almost simultaneously.
So there's a lot
of walking back and forth between what is my studio and the piano. There's, you know, I get those 12 steps get walked a lot.
Because you're not writing lyrics. I mean, I'm sure once in a while, but you're not specifically sitting down writing lyrics at the piano because you've got a separate space for that. It's like a writer. I mean, a writer
exactly.
has separate
It's a writer.
Spaces.
And also I'm concentrating very much on the words. And the syllables and the stress of the words. I'm sitting at a desk or a computer doing that. But then, you know, but then that's only in combination with the harmonic progression that's happening. And, you know, sometimes you can write a sketch of a beautiful harmonic progression. Also, by the way, I did take, I broke out of the American song and the jazz, which is a very restricted harmonic system. I broke out of that with some lessons from my favorite, one of my favorite people and composers, a friend, Shulamit Ron. Mm. She gave me just a couple tips.
Like concepts, maybe, to grab
tips at the piano. Yeah. And it was like the moment in The Wizard of Oz when, you know, it goes from black and white to color. Really was. It was like she let me break out of that system. So now I have all of harmony at my disposal. And you can hear the difference. I can hear the difference in the music. I can actually hear when I had access to more harmonically. I can hear which songs I'm starting to use the techniques that she taught me.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I can pick and choose from anything in the world harmonically. And so you have more songs that are more complex harmonically and lyrics that become more like poetry for those kinds of songs. The chatty and the funny songs are what they are.
Right, you know. Right. Well, and that's, you
more
know,
smart. That, smart songs.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, though, because all the textures you lay down on the piano, or all the space you leave on the piano, especially in your original songs, but even when you're reworking the standards, or you're delving into some pop tunes and stuff, and you're reimagining the pop tunes, I mean, the chord structure and the harmonics that you're doing, but also the textures that you're doing. And I noticed that, and there's not a lot of people. I mean, I always throw it back to like a Brad Meldow kind of thing, because Brad is really, I mean, he's, you know, textured, but he's a lot like how you can lay down a lot of different textures. Is that something that is just organically, you know, coming out of you, or is that something that you actually thought about and said, you know what, how am I going to do this and this and this? I'm going to try to change this up, as opposed to just, you know, playing chords like a regular jazz person would play chords.
I think that's more natural.
Yeah.
Yeah. Writing is as I said, a lot like a science meets art. The writing of it is, but the actual performance of it is partly, you know, from playing classical piano, that's part of it, that you have access to a technique that allows you to lighten up, or also, you know, recording, hearing yourself back is so important, and I just prefer smaller ensembles to larger ensembles.
More space, too, right?
Yeah, I just prefer that sound. Like my favorite artwork are Cezanne's watercolors, the trees.
Mm-hmm.
I like to see the structure and just some of the paint. So I think it's just my nature that I like densities, as Shulamit Ron calls them.
Mm-hmm.
Densities. So, you know, I like to work with densities.
Yeah. All right, so let's jump back into the back into the Chicago thing. I love going off on tangents, though, because the stuff we're talking about, I think, is it's fascinating to me, and hopefully a lot of people are enjoying this, because this is really incredible. But we got to jump back, because you're at the Mill.
Right.
And how did that gig come up, and how did you meet Dave Gemmelo? Because there's got to be a good story about meeting Dave Gemmelo, because he's like one of the greatest club owners in the world.
Yeah.
Huge jazz music fan, for those of you that don't know. He owns the Green Mill.
Right.
And she's there still every Monday night.
Yeah. I don't remember how I met Dave, but I remember the phone call from Dave. I was still at home, using up my savings, writing music, studying, but not knowing whether or not I wanted to continue in music. I thought maybe I would go back to school.
Right, that's again. What we were talking about, yeah.
Well, no, this is the second
another time.
This is way after having bought the house in Humboldt Park.
Oh, wow, okay.
After the Gold Star, and I was trying to decide if I wanted to continue doing this or if I wanted to go back to school. And so I think a year went by. It was a long time. And I got a phone call from Dave. Well, it's distinctive. When you get a phone call from Dave Gemmelo, it's distinctive. You'll always remember it. You know, hi, this is Dave. You know, and am I high? You know? And he's like, I got this gig, you know, on Sunday nights. And, you know, Dave is brilliant, right? Yep. He's got a Chicago accent, but by no means, you know, that's no. Sometimes he puts that on a little bit. He said, I got this Sunday night gig. It's from 11 to 2 o'clock. I've got this spot. Would you like to come and play and sing? And I said, I don't know, actually. I don't know. I'm not sure I'm ready to do that.
Is this like in the mid-90s or something? Yeah. Or late 90s?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm ready to do that again. I'm not at all sure. He said, you know, why don't you just come and try? Give it a try. And I said, well, can I play with a bass player? You know, because that's more fun for me. And he said, yeah, bring a bass player. So it's okay. All right. So I drove from Humboldt Park, and it was, I think it was winter because it was lonely out. It was, you know, like one of the...
On a Sunday night at 11 o'clock.
Yeah, Sunday night at
11
o'clock. And there were two drunks at the bar. That was my audience, right? Nonetheless, I wasn't sure I wanted to do this, and I wasn't sure I was able to do this.
Yeah.
I really wasn't sure that my introversion hadn't taken over my stage fright. And so I said to Dave, before I went up there, Michael Arnipal was my bass player. Mm-hmm. I said to Dave, I'm not sure I can do this gig. I'm not sure what's going to happen once I get up there. It's been a year. I could start screaming, yelling, crying, or I could just leave. And he said, well, whatever you do, I'll pay you for it.
Okay.
That gave me so much freedom.
Yeah.
So I said, okay. And so I went up there, and I was nervous. I was unsure, and I had two drunks at the bar, you know.
Right.
So I wasn't very showbiz, and strangely, that gig, my back was to the audience because of the way the piano was, and it was for years. My mm-hmm. back was to the audience. But then again, we started getting in, you know, huge crowds, and my back was still to the audience. So then it became a problem that they couldn't see me sing. And so right. then we went up on the front stage Sunday nights, and then he added Monday nights to that.
Okay.
And then
you were in the back. You were behind the bar?
I was behind the bar, yeah. That's how I started there. And I was there for many years. And to many people will remember that as their favorite time when it wasn't quite so busy yet and they would come in really late on a Sunday.
Right, yeah.
So we had to go to the front stage because I just couldn't control the crowd with my back. And I also started to feel afraid.
Yeah, all these people staring at your back. You can't keep an eye on anybody, too.
And it was the smoke. Also, I have asthma. And it was the smoke. Since they were watching me, they were all blowing it at me.
Yeah.
So we went up the front stage on Sunday nights, and then he extended that to Monday nights because we were doing so well with the crowds, and then I think I let Sundays go because they were so late, and I didn't want to do that, and he got someone else.
And you've been there ever since?
Well, I took a break. I had an asthma attack, and my doctor told me that I could no longer go back into a club with smoke, so I quit.
Oh.
I quit the Green Mill. Reluctantly, but mm-hmm. you know, you have to breathe. Breathing is
kind of key.
Breathing is key, as they
especially your singing too with the
yeah,
smoke.
Yeah, in the emergency rooms, they know like breathing is the thing, you know. So I had to quit, and then he called and he called back after a year. I was off for a year, and he called back and he said, if we make Monday night no smoking, can you come back? And I said, I can. Yeah, I would love to. That was before the no smoking ordinance.
Wow.
So that was the only place in Chicago where you could go and have a drink and listen to music with no smoke mm-hmm. was for Monday nights. And then very quickly after that, maybe a year or two after that, the Chicago smoking ordinance came in. But I used to make people in Turkey, in Istanbul, they couldn't smoke.
Yeah.
And the club owners were so nervous. They were like, nobody's going to stay. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't. But they all did it.
Sure.
They were all so nice to me. And I would thank them for doing it. And they would be like, yay, you know. And I'd give them a smoke.
Well, you know, you brought up a point there, though, too. I didn't even think about it. When you're over in Europe, I mean, I'm sure everybody's smoking. That must be in your rider or something, that there's no smoking.
Now it's in my rider that not only can they not smoke, they can't smoke during the day. Any time during the day.
Oh, really?
Nobody can smoke because I can smell it, right?
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
They quit for a day. They're going to Patricia Barber concert.
Yeah,
that's good for them. You're making everybody healthy in Europe.
Right.
That's good. So you're at the Green Mill. But also, I mean, to think that Dave Gemmelo would cut smoking out of his club for one night just for you. I mean, that kind of shows you, you know, first of all, he obviously loves you, loves your music and all that stuff. But what a supporter of the arts, too, to be able to do that, because he knew that he wanted you there.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
He's everything that his legend says he is. He's an incredibly smart businessman.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and every they say that every really successful businessman has had failure, and he has. He, you know, went broke on the couple clubs first.
Sure.
And now he's way past that. Yeah. You know, he's doing fine.
Yeah.
And so he knows the business very well.
Yeah.
And so that's great. And he's also very loyal to people who have been loyal to him. Mm-hmm. And one of the agreements that I made with him that was, never talked about it, but I think I told him, but he didn't ask for it. I just said that, you know, I won't work anywhere else in Chicago except for special events like at the Harris Theater, you know,
right.
or this or that. I won't work in another club. I won't do that so that I can pull mm-hmm. for a Monday night. And I will never phone in a performance. I promise I will never come in here and be tired or act tired
yeah.
and phone it in. And if my musicians do that, they won't be there with me the
right.
next week. So
right.
That has kind of worked for us.
Mm-hmm. You know, talking about that, and that's such a key point.
Right.
But I think that that's also because, you know, you're thinking of yourself as an artist at that point. You're not just thinking of the mill
right.
as another gig.
Right.
And you're treating your whole career that way.
Right.
As a, you're an artist. You're turning
right.
down major deals
right.
because you're an artist
right.
and you're creating stuff and everything. Did that help? Kind of move you, I mean, how the Blue Note thing came about, but I mean, did that help them kind of just say, oh my gosh, let's get behind her because she's like a true artist. She's not just a piano bar person or she's just not playing one gig after another or something.
I don't think they think things like that. I don't know if they do, but...
I mean, because they took over Premonition, right? And
they did.
That's
they absorbed the Premonition, my stuff from
sure,
Premonition,
sure.
and then my contract with Premonition lapsed, you know,
right.
expired. And then Blue Note offered me their own contract. And so then I was a Blue Note artist with Bruce Lumbo, who was one of the
yeah.
great guys as well. He and Dave would get along well because he was one of the greats in the music business.
With Blue Note, I mean, they don't offer Blue Note contracts, even if they assume a record label, to just anybody.
No, right.
And obviously, I just think that, you know, the way you're still in Chicago playing a steady gig is kind of... unusual. I mean, mm-hmm. for an artist that's also touring the world, that's got, you know, hit, mm-hmm. hit records and all that
right.
stuff. I mean, playing at the Mill, does that keep your chops together? Is that something that's creatively
oh,
that
huge.
You want to do? But then also that kind of goes right along with the Blue Note thing because they want somebody that is constantly creating, right? I mean, so they had to be excited. It had to be a win-win.
Well, I think Bruce liked my music and certainly, I mean, I was all over the world and
right.
still am in
right.
Paris and Istanbul and, you know, this and that. At that time, Blue Note, of course, had offices in all these places, in
oh,
Paris,
yeah.
in Istanbul, and Madrid, and this and that. And those people would come out and say hello, and they would also prepare the city for my appearance.
That's
gone.
It's still amazing.
That's gone.
Yeah.
You know, I still go there, and I still have audiences, but that's because I have a career behind me.
Right.
I would hate to be starting right now.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't know what to tell somebody.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
How do they do it now, like with Blue Note?
I get Blue Note's owned by, you know...
Whoever, right?
Yeah, I mean, whoever.
When
well,
it's
first a hedge fund, and I don't know, maybe Universal now owns everybody. Universal owns my catalog, so I would guess.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean that they own, you know, they're starting to split things apart into publishing and everything else.
Oh, okay. I mean, do you, as an artist, did that all get, like, lumped into a record contract, or do you own...
I own 100% of my publishing.
Oh, okay.
Somehow I thought it was going to be worth something. You know, I had faith in myself, and,
mm-hmm.
and it worked for me until the streaming phenomenon.
Yeah.
And now everybody's lost access to much of their royalty stream.
Right,
yeah.
right. I mean, you know, so talking about the Blue Note thing, so when you got onto Blue Note at first, they started setting up tours right away? I mean, that started really...
They did the same thing that Premonition did. I mean,
yeah.
You know, they were both great. Yeah.
So, I mean, so you're touring the world, you're
mm-hmm.
doing all of that
mm-hmm.
stuff. Constantly recording new material and everything. You're staying at the Green Mill, and now fast forward, you're still doing all of that,
mm-hmm.
and you have a new project that you're working on,
right.
and that's going to be coming out in the spring. All of the original tunes and everything else.
These are art songs that I started as my harmonies started getting more complex. I could write a shorter song, like an art song, like a song by Schumann. I also studied classical music, you know, very closely and,
yeah.
and poets. So they can be more like art songs where you need less of a drummer and it's more like a piano and a singer. And then Renee Fleming walked into the club and she wanted to do some of that music. And so some of my stuff are now qualify as art songs. And so jazz singers can sing them and classical singers can sing them. And Renee and I did a short tour together.
Right, yeah, right.
And so that's what will be on this next record. People who are super fans and that come in and hear my concerts know the songs I'm talking about, but they haven't been recorded yet. So they
is she
be.
On the new recording?
No. She, let's say she would probably have first right of refusal.
Sure,
but,
right.
But no, I haven't.
So are you playing? So you did it. How did that whole thing come about? Just because she walked into a club and she heard your...
Yeah, she likes to relax after, you know, being a big star.
And you had never met her before?
I was starting to be a fan of opera. It was always something I wanted to look into, but I was busy. And then I started to look into opera, and I knew who she was, and I certainly loved her voice. And yeah, so when she walked in, it was, I was very surprised. I was like, is this the Renee Fleming that's that right. Renee Fleming? You know, is that the same person? And but she's so easygoing and down to earth.
I'm sure.
She's like, so lovely.
Yeah.
And so she likes to come in and relax and hear some, she loved jazz. She started as a jazz singer, and I think she's
oh, really?
Becoming a jazz
yeah.
singer again. So she would love to have a glass of wine after a hard day, and yeah. so she would like to be anonymous. So she would sit in this one table, and there was no light on
so
her.
Just at the mill?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, the Green Mill knows which table, and they would give her the table, and yeah. she'd just sit there and sometimes meet friends or not.
Yeah.
And then one time I went up to her, and I asked her, I said, would you like to hear something special? And she had her iPhone, and she had 5 of my songs on there on a list.
Oh, really?
So not only was she was listening carefully,
man, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So she said, and I was like, wow. So I wrote them down, and I said to the guys, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so we did all 5 down, and then she started talking to me about a concert together and stuff like that.
Yeah, you did. What did you do, 3 or 4 concerts?
Yeah.
I mean, one here and then a couple in New York. And
a couple in Washington, D.C. and yeah. then New York, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing, though. But that's how that whole thing happens, and I'm always... I always contend that as a jazz musician or even, you know, somebody like Renee Fleming, but that you grow up in a certain way, you come up in a certain way, you're hanging out at a club, you're used to talking to people, you're not like some pop star that's to, you know, started right. when he was 10,
right,
he's
right.
not socialized or anything. I mean, you know, it's like you're used to hanging, you know, and it's just...
Hanging's the thing.
Yeah,
yeah, like when I went to hear Paul or... But we used to do a lot more of that, I got to say. There was so much more of it to do.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot more people playing.
Right.
So you'd get done with your gig, you'd go
over
and
hang out
over here.
Oh, my God, you could go to 3 or 4 on a break.
On a break?
On Rush Street. You could go visit your friends playing down the street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like that community thing. Now you just Facebook everybody, right? Is that what we're supposed to do?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Last question for you, because I wanted to ask you about this. You've had a lot of different configurations of your groups, but they've always stuck with you for a long period of time. How important is it for your music to have kind of like a regular group of guys playing it? Because it's fairly complicated. It's not like somebody can just pop up there and understand what's going on. Even if they're reading down some sheet music, getting that groove working off of what you're doing, how important is that to you to have that steady group of guys that know your material and that you're comfortable getting creative with?
It's really important to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been Patrick Mulcahy and John Dietmeyer for a long time. I've been mixing it up now a little bit because I can. And so when I mix it up, you know, at times I have to choose repertoire that is not as complicated. There, like you said, there's no way that you can come in and play some of my music, even if you're looking right at it. The meter changes, the time just can't be done. But it's good for me, it's good for the guys, and it's now that my guys have children, and this keeps happening to me. It's funny because the cliche is, right, don't hire young women because they're going to get pregnant.
Right.
No, that's not true.
It's the guys, right?
Don't hire young men because they're going to get pregnant.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, all of my musicians have gone from being single guys to being married with children. And then they're more restricted as far as touring.
Sure.
So I have to mix it up so that I always have somebody who knows my music to go on tour. Because they have children.
Well, yeah,
seriously, that's what
I totally understand it because I know, you know, watching you go out on tour, and I think John had just had a baby or something, and I think he was in Europe for like 3 weeks. I'm like, I'm sure that's going over real well at home.
Well, you know, I mean, that's why I have...
That's it,
That's why I have, like, I need at least... 2 trios.
Right.
You know, basically.
But they've got to know your stuff because it's just something that you can't just jump into, which is the whole reason why you're Patricia Barber. All right, we're going to wrap it up. I really appreciate you coming down and being on Chicago Jazz Magazine's November 2018 Chicago Jazz Digital Magazine. Of course, it's all available at chicagojazzmagazine.com. More information on Patricia Barber at patriciabarber.com. And watch out for the new release. It's going to be announced soon. All the details will be coming up, and we'll be sure to add that onto chicagojazz.com and Chicago Jazz Magazine. I appreciate it so much.
Thanks so much. This was lovely.
And thanks again, and we'll see you on the next issue.
Sunglass for your eyes. Do you think that love is blind? Do you think of me like salt? Do you taste me in your tears? Do you think of me like oil? Filthy rich, my dear.